Hello and welcome to Million Dollar Monday. I'm your host, Greg Mazzullo, bringing you real successful people with real useful advice for people with big dreams. I understand big dreams. I turned an investment of $200 and a lot of great advice from some really successful people into my big dream, pro forma, that today is a $500 million company. Well, hello and welcome. We're going to be talking today about something I'm sure applies to everybody listening at some level that takes supplements. We're going to be talking about making sure that there is better disclosure and testing and transparency in the supplement industry. And I am excited to be joined today by a young man who's passionate about that. His passion has even led him to found a business. Please welcome Callaway Cook, founder and president of Illuminate Labs.
Yep. Thank you for having me, Greg.
Thanks for joining us. All right. Well, very interested. This guy who takes a number of supplements myself. And I have to admit, maybe I'm about as bad as the last thing I saw on Facebook.
Yeah, it's common.
This will help you lose weight. This will help you whatever, right? I think maybe I should try that. Well, anyhow, Callaway, I'm excited to chat with you. And, you know, for a young man who's only 28, you've really accomplished a lot. So let's start at the beginning and tell us a little bit about your growing up years or your educational years. Where did you develop some passion for business ownership, and then eventually the supplement business?
Yeah. So I think that my passion for entrepreneurship really started in college. In high school, honestly, I wasn't the best student. I'm not a big fan of school. You know, I didn't do that well in terms of grades. I don't like sitting. I like learning kind of hands-on, you know? So, you know, went to high school, did all right. I went to Syracuse University for college, the Newhouse School. And that's where I was in an entrepreneurship class. I had the only professor who I've ever had a good relationship with my whole life from high school to college, a guy by the name of Sean Brannigan. He was the entrepreneur in residence there. And I was taking this class and I was just like fascinated by it. And I launched a business that year in college, and it was called Fantasy TV. And so we were going to launch an individualized fantasy sports platform, so you could see the highlights of just the players in your team. We thought it was it was a pretty cool idea. The only issue is there's $1 billion media rights roadblock. So
that's a problem. You
know, yeah. So I had a team and it was a bunch of 19-year-olds and people weren't going to loan us $1 billion to solve the issue. But you know, kind of in that process, the startup failed, but I just kind of like fell in love with it. And I felt like I learned a lot more through that process than in school by far. And I knew that, you know, this is what I wanted to do with my life. I did get a kind of 9-to-5 job after college, but, you know, I quit that 3 years ago and doing the entrepreneurship thing.
So entrepreneur in residence, explain to our folks who are listening who might not know what that means.
Yeah. So a lot of schools will have someone who actually kind of has had success in the business world and has run some businesses, has founded some businesses, has raised money, come in, because a lot of your professors, right, they've never actually had success in the real private world. And that's fine. And it's good. You know, education is an interesting space too, but I feel like you can learn more from someone who's actually done it. So a lot of schools will kind of have a program like that to kind of foster entrepreneurship. And sometimes they'll even loan money to the students to kind of get their business off the ground.
Yeah. Very small angel kind of slices. Sometimes they're even still running their business, but have an office at the university itself. Yeah. I think it's fascinating for those people to do it. I think it's so motivating and inspirational. By the way, you have a lot in common with most of the people I interview and also myself, that the learning style of sit down and shut up and listen for an hour so you can learn something just doesn't work, especially for so many people who are entrepreneurs. So if you're listening and you have trouble sitting down and shutting up and learn for an hour, it's okay. It's probably even a good sign for your entrepreneurship. All right. So somewhere along the way, I know that you were taking supplements and you got frustrated by the lack of information you could get from the supplement companies. Talk to us about, you know, how you germinated the idea for Illuminate Labs and how it goes from an idea to sort of detail by detail. It's not just an idea. It starts to become, and then it is a business.
Yeah. So again, the concept, I didn't immediately start with this as a business idea, right? It started with me as a kind of frustrated consumer. I was taking supplements. I was kind of fascinated by some of the science behind some of these products, whether it was either just a simple mineral or a vitamin blend, whatever. So I had begun taking supplements. I think I reached a point where I was taking like, you know, 5 to 10 different supplements a day. It's a pretty large amount. And I was seeing, I was living in New York at the time when the New York Attorney General had this kind of landmark investigation where 4 out of the 5 herbal supplements they tested didn't even contain the listed ingredient. Wow. So I was like this. Yeah. I was like, that was in, I believe it was in 2016. We actually cited on our site. It was in 2016 or 2015, but I was like, this is crazy. I'm spending all this money on these products. After that came out, I reached out to some of the manufacturers because I was taking some of the like quote unquote high-end supplements. It's just branding. And he's saying, hey, can you just send me the test results? Like, I've become scientifically literate enough to be able to interpret this. I'm sure you guys are doing testing. Not a single one of the companies would send me their test results.
Not one.
These are like major brands. Yeah, unfortunately, in our marketing, we can't mention them by name because we don't want to be sued. But these were like major. These weren't sketchy Amazon resellers. These were like major companies doing tens of millions in revenue. And, you know, that's, as you can imagine, kind of when the idea started. Well, like, this is crazy. I saw a lot of people in person and online voicing the same concerns. And what actually gave me the one data point that gave me that allowed me to raise seed funding for the business was I was looking for kind of proxies to determine like the consumer interest in this specific space in tested clean supplements, right? Because I was like, you know, I'm really passionate about this, but a lot of people might not be. There were two websites. One is called Labdoor and one is called Consumer Lab, which we've actually reviewed on our site, but they review and grade off-the-shelf supplements based on their label accuracy, purity, et cetera. So like the combined traffic to those sites is a perfect proxy for like our early adopter market, right? So those two sites at the time were getting well over 500,000 users a month.
So you used a word there that I think some people might not know. What is an early adopter?
So the early adopter is, you know, when you first go to market, there's going to be a core subset of people who are super passionate about the niche you're in. Yeah. And if you're solving a unique problem that's disruptive, those are going to be the first people who are signing up for your product before it's more refined.
Did you raise money first for the idea? Or what were the specific steps that sort of led eventually to incorporating a business and say, I have a business, this is going to be a business?
Yeah, so I did at least verbally close the agreement for the pre-seed round before incorporating. My timeline was kind of, it was a funny interim period. So I had quit my job because I was like fully in, I was going to do this. Mm-hmm. And in the interim period, I was actually driving for Uber because I didn't want to like, it was fun. That's the grind, right? Like I kind of enjoyed it. And I didn't need to like financially, but I was like, you know, I don't want to lose money in this interim period. I know that raising money could take a while. So for 6 months, I was actually driving for Uber. Seeking funding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got a verbal agreement, incorporated the business, stopped driving for Uber. And the process was, you know, I actually raised money from a family that I knew I went to high school with. You know, raising money can be tricky. I tried to raise from some angels and mm-hmm. I feel like if you don't have a prior relationship, it can be really tough. You know, a lot of them liked the idea, but were just kind of hesitant to write the check.
Especially that first early... Yeah. Family, friends, and associates or angel round, yeah. Almost like the early adopter curve. You know, some of those people want to hear that somebody else put money in and it helps validate the concept. So you were so certain you were going to do this at some point, you actually quit your job and said, I'm going to go raise money to start this thing. And while I'm trying to raise money to start this thing, you drove Uber. Were you concurrently, while you're trying to raise money, doing research around the product itself, what products you would develop, first bring to market, how you'd bring them to the market? Were you doing some of that analysis too? Product analysis, marketing analysis?
Exactly. Yeah. So in that 6 month period, that's when we did all of the research. And I even found the nonprofit laboratory we work with for the testing. I'd identified the contract manufacturer. Every piece was kind of put into place structurally so that when I raised the money, like we were instantly ready to go.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like to me, correct me if I'm wrong, you just said, I'm doing this. And then you quit your job and you forced yourself to build the business plan on the fly, if you will, right? raising the money, validating the concept, finding the labs or whatever, developing whatever the first products were, or at least the idea for them on the fly. I mean, you really developed the plan on sort of on the fly. How much money were you trying to raise? And if you're comfortable telling us about how much money did you raise in that first seed round, if you will?
Low six figures, very low six figures. So, you know, between 100 and 250,000 and, you know, that just went, there's a lot of fixed costs obviously with, physical products. So that just went to the contract manufacturing, that just went to, you know, graphic design. We're getting the bottles designed, getting our website up. I'm still actually not taking a salary. We're reinvesting every dollar. Our whole team is just working on equity. Like, we're very bought into the long-term growth of this business. And, you know, it was actually interesting, like part of the contract agreement when I was raising the funds was that none of it was to go to my salary, because we wanted every dollar to just go into the business growth.
So then how do you feed yourself? How do you pay your rent and food
I should have kind of prefaced this, because I definitely don't recommend that people quit their job if they don't have. So I was fortunate. I got into the crypto space early. So I got into Bitcoin and Ethereum and all that. Okay. That's what allowed me to have some, you know, financial freedom to quit. It actually, you know, it also gave me leverage for the contract negotiations, because obviously if you have no money, it's much tougher. You know, I'm sure you know this, you talked to a lot of entrepreneurs, to raise money, because you have no, everything's about leverage. So I was going to self-fund the company. And because I didn't need to, I was able to have better terms. You know, you got to give up like, you know, 40% or something crazy, your company. If you just, you know, if you got to take the money to make the business work, you got to do what you got to do. But
So you had some money you were going to be able to put in yourself. It wasn't going to be 100% other people's money.
So I haven't put any money myself, but if you need it, like if I couldn't raise funding, I was going to. So I was going to self-fund the business. I was giving myself kind of that 6-month timeline to raise funding. But if we didn't, I was just going to self-fund the business.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I had a conversation with an entrepreneur recently who, because I judge business plan competitions. In fact, my wife and I are co-sponsors of the at the University of Florida, the Big Gator, Big Idea Business Plan, $50,000 business plan competition. And so, I talk with some of the other judges, and some of us older folks kind of bristle at the idea of the younger entrepreneurs asking for money to pay themselves, or at least partially pay themselves. But I've kind of changed my thinking the more I talk with some entrepreneurs who say, you know, yeah, I get it. You know, you don't want me to be taking out an exorbitant salary, but if I have to go, and you don't have to go work because you were successful enough to, but if somebody has to go have a day job to feed themselves, so they can only work on the business, it makes no sense. You got to be able to take some business, some money then to at least make sure that the rent is paid and you got a little bit of food on the table. All right. So how did you determine what the first couple of products would be that you would sell? And how did you take them to market?
Yeah. So when we were brainstorming kind of what are the first product offerings going to be, you know, we realized that we didn't want to do a proprietary blend. So a lot of supplement companies, to have a unique value prop, they'll have a blend that's unique to their products, right? So they'll just mix a bunch of vitamins and herbs, whatever the case may be. And usually there's just no clinical efficacy of the product, right? Because if you're just mixing a bunch of stuff, unless you're funding clinical trials, you have no proof the product worked. Like, we were really passionate about, we wanted to sell products that work. It's not going to work for everyone, but like, there's medical research backing that they work on average, right? The best way to do that, if you don't have the millions of dollars to fund clinical trials, is you just take, you piggyback off existing research. So we said, we're going to sell single herb extracts. So ginseng, ginkgo, you've probably heard of these. These are like some of the most well-studied, most popular herbs. And our kind of go-to-market strategy was, look, there's tens of millions of people in the US alone who are already taking these herbs.
Right.
So since our value add is with the testing, we don't need some sort of weird blend of products that's not proven to work. Let's just do the existing herbs better. Because, you know,
I got it. So what differentiates you in the marketplace is some of the purity or the testing or the proof of your claims as opposed to the competition. Is your product more expensive than the competition as a result, or are you able to bring it in at about the same price?
It depends. There's kind of two different like stratas of supplement companies, right? There's the companies that just compete on price, and they'll sell ginkgo for $8 a bottle. You know, I don't recommend people buy exotic herbs for $8, but you're just very unlikely to be getting what you're paying for. We're right in the kind of price range of the, I would say like the higher end supplement companies, Pure Encapsulations, Thorne Research. The difference is, like, basically none of these companies actually have a value add. They just have great branding. So a lot of companies are selling at the same price what we are, $40 a bottle, just based on branding. But we do have this value add, which makes our product stickier, makes the recurring revenue figures better.
So right now you have four products. What's the plan to add more?
So yeah, we've already identified four more SKUs we want to launch. It just depends on sales volume. But we have got, and it's interesting because as we've grown and as our traffic's grown a lot, we've gotten a lot of useful feedback just from customers reaching out to us saying, are you going to offer this type of product? Are you going to offer a workout product, a protein? Are you going to offer a turmeric product? And that's helped us kind of formulate, what we want to go to market with next.
You know, I was fascinated to read. I know all about S Corps, C Corps, LLCs. And when I was reading about you, you're a B Corp. Talk to us about what that means, man.
Yes. Yeah. So technically we are a C Corp, but we, Benefit Corporation is a formal, incorporation status where basically the company is obligated to consider like the, it's not only its shareholders. Basically the company doesn't only have a fiduciary responsibility to its shareholders, which we do have, but primarily like to society as a whole. So a lot of people have heard of certified B Corps, Patagonia. A lot of companies are getting that. That's a private, people get confused about this a lot. That's like a private company's certification.
Okay.
If you're incorporated as a benefit corporation, that's just the legal entity. And that's what we are. We actually pursue the private certification too. We just found it to be super inefficient.
So is your claim more of like a self-proclaimed claim that you'll be a B Corp, that you'll benefit others? Or did you have to go through some kind of testing or compliance to be called a B Corp?
No, it's an internal thing. There's no compliance. So anyone can incorporate as a benefit corporation. And you could be, as long as you're a corp. So it's not, you could be S Corp, you could be a C Corp. But it does internally structure your decision making so that like your shareholders can't force you out or pressure you by saying, if you're making a business decision that doesn't necessarily lead to the maximal profitability, you have legal protection because of the way you're incorporated.
All right. So since Million Dollar Monday is really all about providing inspiration and advice to aspiring entrepreneurs, what two or three or so advice points would you give to the listeners that are thinking about starting their own business or early on, and why? How did you learn those lessons?
Yeah, I think the biggest piece that even I've recently learned, right, is just invest in what you know, right? So if you run a business, just do what you're an expert in. If you're starting a business, you're not an expert in anything, it's probably not going to go well. But it's something that you always hear when you're thinking about starting a business, and you can get like, I kind of glamorize the 4-hour work week type idea, right? If we could just have this profitable PPC channel, everything's automated, and then we're making millions passively. I wish that I had just done the thing that I'm an expert in, SEO, right from the outset, we'd already have tons more traffic than we do now because it's been scaling so fast. So that's the biggest piece of, but if you're an expert in PPC, do that. If you're an expert writer, do that. If you're an expert in optimizing on page through social, just grind on that until your company is self-sustaining. And then you can just pay people to do the other parts.
I loved your piece of advice about communication, being totally professional until somebody else invites you to be something less than professional.
Yeah, especially in investor relations when, a lot of investors are an older generation. I do think that like there's a lot of people, in my generation or longer who can be super casual, which is good. But it's like, that's not my disposition is always like, I want to lead with respect and I wouldn't want to like do anything that can come off as disrespectful, even if it's not intended that way. So I always, even in my email communications, I try to be kind of extra formal. And then, if someone says, oh, don't call me Mr. This, it's call me by my first name. And then, we can proceed that way.
Yeah. My sense is Mr. is an overreach even. So I'm almost 70, but I'm almost offended a little bit if people try to call me Mr. Like, I don't like that, but I do understand where they're coming from and I'm okay. But I instantly just say, hey, please call me Greg. Right. And I think that's what you mean is you probably would initially maybe say Mr. And then I'd say, just please call me Greg. And
And that was just one example. I mean, another example would be like, I wouldn't show up to this with like a ripped t-shirt. There's just little things that kind of signal your professionalism in your venture.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, your story is very inspirational and it's a proof that you can have an idea, have a frustration, and you can turn that into a business. where there's significant demand, because a lot of people, if you're thinking some way, maybe a lot of other people are thinking that way too. Callaway, your story is inspirational. The lessons that I've even learned in doing the research on your business and on you have inspired me. And I want to thank you very much for taking some time to visit with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time, Greg. And look forward to staying in touch.
For sure.